The concept of spirituality is a really tough one to figure out. People talk about being spiritual all the time. They talk about their spiritual guide. They talk about being spiritual people. What in the world is biblical spirituality?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
So Jack, at the Study Center this weekend, there was a great conference. It was the annual Oktoberfest.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of it, I think, was just spirituality.
Yeah, spirituality in the 21st century, maybe, yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. And I had definitely planned to go, and something came up, and I just made a different decision. And I heard from several people that it was really good.
Oh, that's great.
And, in fact, I heard that your presentation was really good. So let's start there. In fact, you had a couple of presentations.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about those? Because we want to talk about the whole area of what is spirituality in the next couple of weeks.
I had two talks. One was entitled, What is Spirituality? And I tried to answer two questions. First, can we come to terms with what the concept of spirituality is? I chose that topic because I realized most of my life I have been clueless about what people mean by spirituality. It's a very vague, amorphous term that people use in a lot of different contexts. And
well, it's used a ton now.
Yeah.
It's used all the time.
Especially today, yeah. So I was trying to figure out if I could put some thought into what the concept might be and see if I could make any sense out of it for myself. And the paper was a rather bumbling attempt to try to share those conclusions.
Well, that's not what I heard, that it was bumbling.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm really interested. I was really looking forward to going to that conference, and exactly that was my question is, you know, what exactly does spirituality mean? I'm sure that you didn't define it for everybody, but you certainly defined it for yourself and perhaps from a biblical perspective.
Yeah, that was the other question, is what is biblical spirituality in contrast to the other forms of spirituality? What is distinctive about biblical spirituality?
Okay, and before we go there, there was a second talk.
The other one was on Kierkegaard and spirituality. Kierkegaard is a Danish philosopher from the 1800s, and my initial understanding of Kierkegaard and attitude toward Kierkegaard was formed when I was an undergraduate. And the way Kierkegaard was interpreted to me is that he was a champion of irrational faith. And I was enough of a student and disciple of Francis Schaeffer to not buy that. And to this day, I'm convinced that faith is utterly rational and needs to be and ought to be. So I just have always been kind of dismissive of Kierkegaard. But over the years, especially when I was in graduate school and I got exposed to Kierkegaard a lot more, I came to realize that he had been grossly misinterpreted. And it's now my judgment that of all Christian thinkers since the Apostles, Kierkegaard may very well be that thinker who best grasps the nature and dynamic of Christian faith of any of the philosophers. So he's well worth looking at and well worth studying and reading. He's difficult. He's
very difficult.
He doesn't write clearly. He calls himself a poet, and he uses a lot of hyperbole and a lot of shock language and a lot of poetic images that, if you take them literally, just sound wrong. But if you get behind to what he's actually saying, it's very, very profound, I think.
Well,
so I tried to illustrate that.
In the little bit of reading I've done of him, I think his language might be that way because he's trying to get his arms around something so big,
right,
and so profound that he's trying to grasp a language that really doesn't identify exactly what he wants to say. It can't express it. It's too much.
Right.
And so he's using language that's hard to get at.
Yeah.
But let's save him
okay.
to another broadcast.
Okay.
And let's go to the more basic question of what is spirituality?
Okay.
And biblical spirituality. Did you contrast the two, Jack? Did you say what spirituality is to us and our culture, and then contrast that to biblical spirituality?
Yeah, not very effectively, but I try to, yeah. I kind of ran out of time, so I had to cut it short. Okay, what is spirituality? The conclusion I came to, see if I can get this in a nutshell, in the paper I identify what I think is the root primitive notion of spirit. I stick with the word spirit to start with. What is its root primitive notion? And then I try to trace how that got broadened and expanded throughout the history of civilization. As different worldviews came to be and came into prominence, I think they kind of expanded the notion of spirit. So, for example, the primitive notion, I think, is simply, it's a word that describes what it is that makes a living human being different from their corpse. You know, if you have a corpse lying lifeless on the ground, that keen sense that all of us have that nobody's home, that eerie sense that there's nothing different, but there's everything different about the corpse and the person we knew.
You just know it.
Yeah.
Their life left them. They left themselves.
Right. And we use, I think the primitive meaning of the word spirit identifies that something that is the difference between the corpse and the living person.
Whatever it is that left was the spirit.
Right, right. The both in Greek and Hebrew, and I believe in Latin, the meaning, the word that's used for spirit is the same word that's used for breath. And that's understandable. I mean, that one of the obvious notable differences between a corpse and a living person is they're not breathing. So that correlation somehow translated into the same word being used. I think it's kind of naive and chauvinistic of us to assume that the ancient world believed that the breath was the spirit. Maybe they did, but I don't think that's likely. They're actually much more intellectually sophisticated than we give them credit for. I think it's just one of those strange things in language where we see correlations and we use words to stand for one thing that is correlated with another thing.
Again, we're trying to grasp it, being able to describe something in as simple and as descriptive terms as we can, and we don't always get it exactly.
Right, right.
Well, so speaking of terms, let me just go to something really quickly. Why did you say that was chauvinistic of us?
Well, we have a tendency, or I think C.S. Lewis in one of his works called it intellectual snobbery. There's this tendency for us to think that we moderns are more intellectually sophisticated and more, more intellectually hip than older people were. I think evolution has helped advance this notion that, you know, they drooled and could barely grunt back in the old days, but we really know all kinds of things. We're really intelligent. The more I read, the more I recognize that actually we have devolved. Yeah.
Devolved.
Intellectually, in terms of philosophically and metaphysically, we are much less sophisticated today than most of the ancient world was.
Well, Jack, I can't see how we would not be.
Yeah.
Just merely because of the way that we spend our time. We're
right.
really fast. We're going places. We don't spend time at home late at night when there's no light.
Right.
Thinking and talking and reflecting and being with ourselves. We're running to somebody else's house, or we're watching TV, or we're doing something. And to get that kind of
really intellectually stimulating sitcoms, for example.
That, yeah, you're kind of making a comment there. Now you made me Jack. It just takes time.
Yeah.
To sit and reflect, and we have lost that.
Yeah.
Or at least we've lost a great deal of that, and we've left a lot of our thinking to scholars rather than taking the time to sit and reflect ourselves.
Right.
And, you know, I have to point the finger at myself.
Yeah,
I don't.
All of us. It's just our culture. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just astounded when I think about in earlier parts of our country, earlier periods in our country, where farmers and shopkeepers would go to a lecture at night for entertainment. Can you imagine us going to a lecture for entertainment? I mean, just We just live in such a different world.
Well, actually, I would love to do that.
Yeah.
It would be nice to have, you know, a lecture series that's just easy to go to because there's nothing else going on, and the rest of the community will be there, so it was kind of a community feel.
Yeah, social event. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have, yeah. I just think that's kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
But I'm a little strange in that way.
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. So I digressed us asking about what Chauvin.
So I think that's sort of the primitive, original notion of spirit. Well, that's pretty narrow. I mean, that we don't get our concept of spirituality just from there's this thing that's a part of a human being that makes me a person and that makes me a living, viable person. So I think the next major step was when we get to the polytheistic worldview. The polytheistic worldview viewed all of reality as kind of a two-story reality. There's this lower story that we live in, this human experience and the nature and the environment that we live in. That's the lower story. And then up above that is an intangible, invisible, immaterial realm that is above and beyond this whole reality that we live in. And the view of the ancient polytheists was that realm, well, I should change that. This realm that we live in actually mirrors that upper story realm. So what happens up there has a direct impact on what happens down here. So all of polytheistic religions, the sacrifices, the prayers, the incantations, the various forms of worship, were all calculated to try to control what was happening up there, because they knew that what happened up there controlled what happened up here.
So it's like a circular thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to control up there so it would be good. So in turn, it would be good for me in the lower story.
Precisely. Yeah.
And it just kind of doing a circle.
Yeah, I want the weather to go the way I need the weather to go for my crops. I want my cattle to be fertile. I want my wife to have children. I want my city-state to be able to have military victory over the city-state across the way. I don't want to lose and be defeated and sent into slavery. I want a few slaves of my own. I mean, that... And how do I try to guarantee that all that happens? I make sure that the forces that be in the upper story are on my side and are working toward my benefit and are seeking to do good and benefit to me rather than my enemies.
So in other words, in the lower story, in our human, tangible way, we're trying to kind of appease the upper story,
mm-hmm.
trying to make them like us, trying to make friends with them,
right.
So that they'll kind of give them gifts so they'll give us gifts back.
Exactly. Because the powers that be in the upper story were perceived to be people-like, person-like, with wills and desires and passions akin to what we recognize we have within ourselves. I mean, there's really two ways to see the ultimate forces behind reality. One would be that they are law-driven, like the forces of nature, that they just obey their nature, they obey the laws of their nature, they just have to do what they have to do, they will always act the same way in every situation. The other way to conceive of it is that they are more like people, that is, they're generally predictable. I mean, they're sort of predictable, but they're not really predictable. There's a huge element of unpredictability about them. That's how we experience each other. You know, we know one another's character, we know one another's personality, and we kind of know what we can expect from one another, but you never know when that very complex person is going to surprise you.
Yeah, I might get mad at you today and, you know, I might get mad at you today and throw your coffee on you.
Exactly, yeah.
And if the gods are like that up in the upper story, then I better be careful and be nice to them so that they don't, like, PMS on me. Or
yeah, exactly. I need to do everything I can to make sure that I'm keeping them happy.
Okay.
Well, in terms of the concept of spirit, it sure seems to me like the concept of spirit, that narrow concept that we had that just described that intangible, invisible, immaterial reality in me that gave me personhood and gave me life and vitality, that got extended to the whole cosmos. That whole upper story was spirit to the world as my spirit is to my individual personhood. That realm and all of the gods, all of the spirits, spiritual forces within it, were what gave life and vitality to the cosmos and gave it shape and gave it definition and dictated the course of its history. So now we have the concept of spirit radically expanded now to include not just something about me, a human individual, but a whole dimension to the universe, to the cosmos. Well, I won't go on. I traced various stages of the concept throughout history, but I think we've already seen enough to recognize where our concept of spirituality comes, and that is after centuries of different worldviews coming in and making their contributions and making their suggestions about what reality is like, I think we come to the 20th century and we see that our concept of spirituality is more or less just kind of a summation of all those different possibilities, a summation of all the different components to reality that, that may or may not be there, so that our concept of spirituality is that spirit is what transcends the whole cosmos, or if it doesn't transcend the whole cosmos, it's in some kind of upper story of this cosmos, some upper level that transcends the ordinary material physical world that we live in. Or in some cases, some modern materialists who don't believe in spirit really, they believe that there's only material, even they will have a concept of spirituality because they believe that there are some physical forces, some subtle physical forces that the law of physics barely even knows or maybe hasn't discovered yet that create unusual effects and unusual phenomena in our world. And ultimately, they may argue that they're physically caused, materially caused, but they're so unusual that they transcend the ordinary. They transcend my normal, ordinary experience. They are what we call paranormal. So, you know, a lot of your late night explorations into the paranormal are probably by people who believe the scientific materialistic description of the world and don't believe in spirit, strictly speaking, but they're fascinated by the spiritual, if you see what I mean. They're fascinated by the paranormal. And what's interesting, and then the nature of that, of those spiritual forces, those unusual, extraordinary forces, they may be personal, they may be impersonal, they may be such that they can be affected by my choices and my actions. Maybe they can't be affected by my choices and my actions. Every worldview will answer some of those questions differently.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic idea of spirituality then is forces that one way or another transcend my everyday ordinary experience and have an impact on it, control it, such that I really should be interested in doing whatever I can to affect those forces, because those forces in turn are going to have an impact on my everyday life. That's the concept of spirit, that there's something out there that can change my life, in other words. And exactly what it is and what its nature is going to depend on the particular worldview that I prefer, that I embrace.
And it seems like it's very much more in vogue today to see that, say that I'm a spiritual person than I believe in God.
Yes, right. That only makes sense if we believe what the Bible says about our intrinsic tendency to be in rebellion against God. One of the ways our rebellion against God manifests itself is to try to commit the ultimate insult against God and ignore him and believe that he's not important, or believe that he's not even there.
Or the way a lot of 12-step programs talk about it, it's believe God in the way I see him.
Mm-hmm.
Believe in a power that I define. For some reason, the words, I know them, are leaving my mind right now, but it's defining God in the way that I want to, rather than bending my knee to the God
that's actually there.
That is defined in the Bible. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes me in charge. Me being able to decide, yeah, there's a spiritual thing out there, but I get to decide what it is.
Mm-hmm. And it plays into the very popular notion today that it's not really God who makes a difference in the world, it's my idea that there is a God that makes a difference in the world. Or, to put it another way, religion is not about coming to terms with truth. Religion is about adopting some powerful ideas that psychologically have an impact on us that changes us. Well, that's not at all the biblical notion of religion and spirituality.
It's biblical more about religion. Me. It's more about me and wanting to define something that makes me feel more secure, more comfortable, more something, and not really having to be subject to that something.
Right.
So when you were talking about wanting to make these gods happy, that the ancients were speaking of, you kind of brought that concept into the present, and I don't hear that as much, Jack, because I think it's more that instead of the gods or spirituality having an impact outside of me to me, it's more that if I'm spiritual, then I have an impact.
Well, yes, that's right. The way I would define spiritual is, I think we mean one of two things by it. Either being interested in those forces that transcend my ordinary experience and could have an impact on it, or having some kind of unusual ability to affect them, or both, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about a spiritual person, we mean someone who is not just preoccupied with the ordinary, normal, everyday things of life. They recognize that there's some dimension that transcends the ordinary mundane affairs of life, and they're particularly interested in that. And perhaps that they are particularly capable and skillful. They have the knowledge, the wisdom, the power, the wherewithal to affect changes, to affect that spiritual realm, that transcendent realm, and therefore have an impact on their everyday affairs. They can do unusual things. Unusual things happen in their lives. Why? Well, because they are in touch, if you will, with forces that go beyond the ordinary forces of reality. That's a spiritual person.
That's a spiritual person, not as defined in the Bible, but a spiritual person is our culture.
In our popular culture, exactly. Right. Spirituality, then, it seems to me, just simply defines the institutions, the practices, the routines, the exercises, the belief system that I adopt and embrace in order to have an impact on those spiritual forces, however I understand them, however I define them, that can turn around and have an impact on my life. So when we talk about Hindu spirituality, for example, what we mean is there's a certain worldview, a certain set of beliefs, a certain set of perceptions about reality that logically lead to a certain set of rituals and exercises and attitudes and practices and institutions that are all part of a coherent fabric that is all calculated to give me the ability to have some kind of impact on forces that transcend the ordinary in order that I can control to some extent my ordinary world. I can achieve what I want or what I need in this ordinary world. That's Hindu spirituality. New Age spirituality has a different set of beliefs and a different set of exercises and practices and rituals and sacraments and institutions that are going to be a part of its attempt to control the powers that be, the spirits, so that I can thereby control my everyday life. And then, if you want to talk about biblical spirituality, it would define it the same way. The Bible presents a certain worldview, a certain set of beliefs, a certain set of assumptions, perceptions of what reality is, and what follow would be a certain set of exercises and routines and practices, potentially, that I would engage in order to be rightly related to the powers or power that is, and so that it would have some impact on my life. One of the things that I explored briefly and wish I had time to explore more fully is the difference between biblical spirituality on the one hand and what I called folk Christian spirituality on the other hand. Often they get all mushed together in our own minds, but I think they really are fundamentally different conceptions of spirituality.
So what is folk Christian spirituality and what is biblical spirituality?
Well, probably there's two fundamental differences. First of all what I came to the conclusion that all spirituality really has this particular goal in mind. And every other spirituality, with the exception of biblical spirituality, sees the ultimate goal in mind as something roughly like personal fulfillment. We might call it happiness loosely, but I like the term personal fulfillment better. We want, there's something lacking, there's something missing, there's an emptiness in my existence, in my being, and I want that filled. And I see my spirituality as a way of filling that void somehow, making whole what is not whole, what I don't experience as whole, making complete what I experience as incomplete, making full what I experience as empty. And I would argue that folk Christianity, along with Hindu spirituality and New Age spirituality and secular spirituality and every other kind of spirituality that's out there, has the goal of personal fulfillment in mind. So why do I engage in this spirituality? Why am I embracing this spirituality at all? Because I want the void filled, and I'm seeking to find the key to filling up that emptiness, that hollowness in me. Biblical spirituality is an exception to that. That when you look at the worldview, the understanding of life and reality that the Bible teaches, what you quickly come to understand, I think, and people who've listened to past programs will understand the context for this that we've tried to lay out. The goal of biblical spirituality is not fulfillment, but what the Bible calls sanctification instead, what we've described as wisdom, understanding. There are many aspects to this thing called sanctification. Faith, belief, trust are aspects of it as well. But the important thing is not so much what it is, but what it isn't. It isn't fulfillment. So it shouldn't surprise us if we take a look at our Christian walk, our Christian discipleship, our life of faith, and come to the conclusion, this is not fulfilling me. This is not satisfying me. There's still some very, very important problems about my existence that have not been solved, and this Christian faith has not solved them. The reason being that the perspective that the Bible brings is that real, true, authentic fulfillment of my existence is only promised when I leave this present age and I become a citizen of the kingdom of God in the age to come. There will be fulfillment. There will be real, authentic satisfaction of my existence, the longing of my heart that gnaws at me and nags at me right now will finally be satisfied. The hunger will be finally satisfied. But there's no guarantee, no promise, no hint that I should expect that will occur here and now in this life. Well, that's a really dramatic and profound difference between biblical spirituality and what I call folk Christian spirituality and any other kind of spirituality in the world, for that matter, is that it has a very different goal in mind and sees its goal very differently.
The problem is, Jack, with what you're saying is I can imagine that lots of people who are listening I think would really disagree with you. I think one of the reasons, and there might be many, but one of the reasons is because a lot of us, especially in my generation, our generation, came to Christ with this notion, I think it was even in a little booklet perhaps that said God came to fill the void, mm-hmm. and that we're going to have personal satisfaction, that our life will kind of turn around and be so much better. And you are really, trampling that.
Well, yeah, I understand that. And I was trained in that same set of assumptions and have taught it for years. It was like an unspoken assumption that we all took for granted, that just come to Jesus and he will make your life whole. I never questioned that. It wasn't until many, many years into study that I really began to see, but that's a very radically different assumption than the apostles have.
And what happens if you're right, and what happened in my life is that I really did believe that myself. And when I started to find that doing the spiritual disciplines that I was doing in order to make my life full, that's what people said to do. If you come to Christ and then you do particular things, then your life would be very fulfilling. Mm-hmm. When that didn't happen, and in fact, when I faced into suffering and difficulties in my life, I felt like I had fallen away from the faith.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was really going in the wrong direction, and I see that a lot with the people with whom I work in my counseling, is they're actually coming into a greater, deeper understanding of themselves, of God. Their wisdom has increased profoundly, and yet they will say to me, I have lost my faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because their definition of their faith is based on adhering to certain spiritual disciplines as opposed to becoming a different kind of people who see life and God and the world in a very different way.
Yeah, and not only are they not practicing what they have been taught to practice, but they're not seeing the results that have been promised for that, and that's why they see themselves as spiritual failures, I'm sure.
Well, and before they saw them as spirit, often these people have seen themselves as spiritual successes because they are looking at results that I think are different than the ones you and I have talked about.
Right.
They certainly are people who are looked up to in their community because they are doing all sorts of things that look really good. These are people who have come to believe after working at these spiritual disciplines, doing them, being encouraged to do them, feeling kind of there's something special about them or something, they've kind of transcended the normal, that all of a sudden when they're facing into reality of life in a different way, they're not getting the encouragement from other people that they're very spiritual. And they're also kind of feeling this sense of, they just walked into the suffering of life and it just doesn't feel
mm-hmm.
at all like what they had anticipated. But they had come to believe, I guess this is where I was trying to go, they had come to believe that it was true. They'd come to believe that their spiritual disciplines and the way they acted was really evidence of their spirituality.
Mm-hmm. That's right. For people who are balking at what I'm saying for that very reason, that it all seems very true to them and very true to their experience.
Absolutely. They would not question it even 1 ounce.
Right.
In fact, I have people that say to me, if I looked at myself in a mirror, or if I could look at myself 5 years ago to today, I would not recognize me. I wouldn't know me. And I would say somebody has put my face on a different person because they so thoroughly believed in their own spirituality as it looked like to them. And now what they're walking through with God is so different that they just can't recognize themselves.
Right. Part of what explains that phenomenon, we have to really recognize this, is how our beliefs can actually affect our perceptions. That is, we do see what we believe we should see to a large extent. I know that was true in my own life, that I would have described myself as a person who, you know, when people talked about the doctrine of we're sinners, I would give kind of a casual nod to that, but you know, something deep inside was saying, but not really. I mean, yeah, all those other people are, but I'm not such a bad person. And I would look at my life in vain for any actual example of sin, because I had a belief system that encouraged me to look to certain virtues that my culture, my worldview defined as virtues, to look at those, see them in me, and then pat myself on the back for being such a good person. And all the things that the Bible would actually tell me were red flags that maybe not all was well, those weren't really even a part of my catalog. They weren't even on the list, on the checklist for evaluating myself. And if someone were to bring one of those up, well, yeah, that's true, but what do you expect? That's demanding a lot of a human being, isn't it? God surely is not demanding that. And it's just so easy to get into a frame of mind where my own belief system affects the way I actually see experience. So we say something like, my experience confirms my belief system. Well, sure it does. Because your belief system has in large measure dictated your experience, the way you experience yourself, the way you experience your life.
I think, Jack, also, am I interrupting you?
No, that's fine.
I think also, Jack, we have a belief system that's based on a biblical truth as we understand it. Like,
mm-hmm.
I might say, I'm supposed to be very much subject to my husband, and maybe a wife will really try to do that. But her belief system of what being subject is may be that she has become a non-thinking person who is willing to be a doormat to everybody. Well, that person sincerely and thoroughly believes that they are doing the right thing.
Right.
But they may be completely unaware of what maybe the truth is about what subjection, biblical context, means. Or someone might say, okay, I'm supposed to be serving. So they're very much serving, and yet they're resenting the service.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of makes it no good. Go ahead.
And yet that woman may very well say, my experience confirms the truth of the Bible as I'm understanding it, because my husband and I don't fight.
Right.
Or something to that effect.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
We don't fight, and probably the reason they don't fight, and I'm sure this is the implication you're bringing, is because she doesn't have an opinion. She
right.
doesn't think. She's given that up. And so, of course, there's not going to be any fights. I've had so many people that say we had this perfect marriage until I, you know, went back to school. And then the woman went back to school, and it wasn't perfect anymore because she started to think, started to contribute, and then felt really bad because then she wasn't being a, as she would see it, a submissive wife. So I just was trying to bring up
right.
some kinds of examples to try and help right. us understand this.
Yeah, concept. That's a very good example. That's what I'm talking about, is that we define success in a particular way, we define working in a particular way, and then by doing that we can... our experience will confirm our misconception of submission, our misconception of marriage, and so on. They all kind of work together, and my own conception of what would be evidence supporting it is itself faulty.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to challenge it, we have to step outside of the whole framework of beliefs and ask ourselves, but is any of that true? Is any of that right? And that's why Bible study is so crucial, it seems to me. Because we can get into a system of thinking that's going to be self-confirming. It's going to be self-supportive to a large degree. And one of the things that Bible study does is, if I approach it with integrity, is it blows all of my systems apart. And it says, nope, wrong, go back to the drawing board, start over, rethink this whole thing, because you're not on the right track.
Okay, Jack, but I want to add another piece. Is there's another way to do that. For people who, it was very difficult, for example, for me to on my own face the Bible with integrity, because I just couldn't get it very well. And even though I was studying under people like yourself, it just somehow it didn't come as alive to me as it does to you. You read the scripture and you pick up on it much more thoroughly than I do. And I was so. And I think you were, but I so influenced by a folk Christianity concept and by just the basic concepts that I grew up with from the beginning and really kind of hammered into me,
mm-hmm.
that it was hard for me to change my mind and to look beyond my own beliefs that confirmed my lifestyle, that
right.
you know, that whole circular pattern that left me pretty much in the dark. I really had to face into my own sinfulness. And so where I felt self-righteous and where I was being really a good Christian, because I really was following through with many of the spiritual disciplines that I thought were right and good and what made me a follower of Christ, all of a sudden I found myself a woman that covets, a woman that's jealous, a woman that's self-righteous, a woman that thinks she's better than other people. And all those things just blew apart this whole concept of me as a very mature person, and I had to go back to the drawing board and see that, oh, this is what being a sinner looks like. And it was very humbling, and it very much caused me to kind of have to look and rethink everything that I thought about Christianity, and which has brought me to a very different kind of Christianity. Instead of me thinking that there's a thing I can do to please God, or a particular ways to transcend my experience now, it seems to me that spirituality doesn't transcend my present experience, but spirituality comes in and through the experience of my mundane life, like, am I going to tell you the truth today?
Right.
Am I going to yell at my child when I want power over them rather than listen to them? Am I going to care about what somebody says even when it has a negative impact on me or a difficult impact on me? Am I willing to experience the pain of rejection and do something that I think is right or not? All those kind of mundane kind of choices that happen in my life seem to be the process through which God's taking me to sanctify me. It doesn't necessarily feel good, but there is a sense of fulfillment in having done what's right, having done what's good, having done what fits reality, and having faced into the truth about who I am and about who God is and about what my actions are like, there is a sense of very deep and profound peace at times when I do that. I might be feeling an extreme amount of rejection from somebody because of a decision I made, but on the other hand, I have a sense of, but I think I did a good job here.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, yeah. In fact, you just stole my second point.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
It's just because I'm so smart.
Yeah, my second point in the difference between folk Christianity and biblical Christianity and biblical Christianity and all other forms of spirituality is that the way to the goal, first of all, we conceive the goal differently. It's not personal fulfillment, it's sanctification. But
And I'm just going to redefine that again as sanctification, as being a person who has grown in wisdom and understanding of the gospel, of themselves, of the world, of life.
Right.
And who is changing as a result of that.
Yeah, their desires and priorities and attitudes and values are all being transformed.
What they want is different.
Yeah. The other difference is that the way to that goal is conceived differently. In folk Christianity, it's conceived to be somehow mediated through unusual, extraordinary experiences of one kind or another. In biblical Christianity, it's exactly what you just defined.
Mundane.
It's the mundane, ordinary, everyday experience and the critical either-or choices that I make day in and day out about what is my life going to be all about. Am I going to obey or disobey? Am I going to choose life or death? Am I going to choose to love God or to hate God? I mean, different ways of describing the choices that we make, but they all come down to these critical, life-defining, existence-defining choices that we make in the nitty-gritty of everyday, ordinary life. No transcendent experiences, no extraordinary experiences, just the hard, difficult choices of life. Whereas in folk Christianity, we, in other forms of spirituality, we're seeking to kind of promote some kind of experience that takes me out of the ordinary. An extraordinary feeling or an extraordinary depth of feeling, an extraordinary state of consciousness, a perception of some kind. That's why in the early 60s, the experiment with hallucinogenic drugs was really one of the beginnings of an experimentation with a whole new kind of spirituality, because it altered one's state of consciousness. And if your concept of spirituality is, that's the way I will attain personal fulfillment, is to get out of the humdrum of life and get into some place where it's extraordinarily, it's a mind-altered experience, it's an extraordinary experience, maybe that's where happiness is to be found. And so what's happened within Christianity is we turn something like worship, for example, into not a part of my gratitude toward God, an ordinary thing, a normal thing that could be a part of normal spirituality, but we seek in worship to gain an extraordinary experience, a mind-altering state, another state of consciousness, an extraordinary depth of feeling, and we are hopeful that maybe in that extraordinary depth of feeling, maybe happiness is to be found, maybe real fulfillment of my existence is to be found. That's not the biblical conception of it.
I really agree with that. That in lots of our worship, we're trying to transcend what's here and now. We're trying to do that in lots of different things. I think sometimes, I was reading a book about tongues, and although I think tongues definitely has a place, and I'm not sure exactly how, I don't get it all, I must say, but to use tongues as a way to transcend my present reality, just to give myself a good experience, I think can lead me, or worship or tongues or whatever, can lead me away from this understanding that really what my spirituality comes down to, what my walk with God looks like, to say it differently, is making decisions every day that are difficult for me very often.
Right.
It has to do with, am I going to, and I'm just going to give some more examples because I think it's hard to grasp, am I going to be a person who gets hard and tight when I don't like something and start laying down rigid rules for other people to make me feel safe? that's something that I would like to do. I mean, that I tend toward, I don't like doing it, I do, but I tend toward it, and it's wrong. Or am I a person on the other end of the continuum who will just, you know, play dead when something comes along that may present a conflict? And instead of standing up to the conflict and maybe presenting what I think is right or true, am I not willing to do that and just kind of play dead? Even when, just for my own personal safety, even when I'm doing that, it might take away from somebody else's safety or somebody else's maturity or somebody else's growth. Am I willing to think about being generous when what I would like to do is be selfish? Am I willing to look at my own needs when that's scary for me and not call my looking at other people's needs and trying to meet their needs as good, when the reality is I'm only looking at your needs because I'm afraid to look at my own needs? Do you follow that one?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
So there's all these kind of difficult ways to approach life, and in them, there's a lot of growth. In not looking, approaching life in ways often that are difficult, I can kind of move away from my opportunities to develop the kind of character that God wants to in me.
And which is the true goal of true spirituality.
Is developing that character.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But I wanted to go back to worship for a minute. I don't know, just maybe this is just for my own good, but I'm going to do it anyway, Jack. It seems like worship can really be used just to kind of transcend to a different experience. On the other hand, it seems to me that there is certainly a place to understand God as big.
Mm-hmm.
And to be kind of brought into an understanding of that in a way that's awe-inspiring. When I was young, I went to my whole family went to an Episcopal church, and there were stained glass windows, and the ceilings were high, and there was a cross up there. And I had this sense that God was bigger than myself, and God was somebody who was strong and could protect me, and I've carried that with me. I think when we don't have any worship that understands God as big, as awesome, then we start to make him, or at least I have started to make him, more like you and me. More like this person that doesn't really have transcendent power of the universe, of the world, of everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think worship, if I am acknowledging that, and not just my gratitude toward him, but also acknowledging who he is and being awed by that, can inspire the same kind of out-of-body type experience in a good way as just worshiping in order to get an out-of-body experience. Do you follow me?
Right, yeah. There's a lot to talk about there. Maybe we should do that sometime. But, yeah, there's no question but what seeing a beautiful sunset, for example, you can just be overcome by a sense of the bigness, the wisdom, the beauty of God. Stand in a stand of huge redwoods and just be overcome by this sense of awe at the majesty that's there. And we may or may not connect that with God. As Christians, hopefully we would, and recognize that the Creator is the one who's really awesome, even beyond the awesomeness of the redwoods themselves.
Or even, Jack, seeing words that speak of something that's so bigger than ourselves.
And say that again.
Or even seeing words in worship.
Right, sure, absolutely.
That are so much bigger than our own experience, that can create an awesome understanding of who God is, like looking at the redwoods.
Because music itself is an aesthetic experience that is moving. I mean, it's almost like it's its own language that has an impact on us. That's just a normal part of God-given humanity, that we can be moved by those things, and appropriately so. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that, and there can be something very beneficial and very profitable about using those things as a way of another way, an alternative way of communicating to us truths about God.
And certainly the Psalms are totally full of pride.
Exactly, exactly. That's exactly their purpose, their intended purpose. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, and certainly that's what worship in part is. But it would be the mistake is twofold. When we identify that as somehow a transcendent experience, it's not transcendent. I'm not having any different feeling when I'm standing in the redwood forest than some non-Christian some atheist who is just struck by the bigness of the universe as well. We have the same emotional experience, enter the same state of consciousness. There's nothing spiritual about that in of itself. What will make it spiritual is if I come to understand, if it leads me to greater wisdom. And that happens ultimately just as God himself speaks to me through that event and speaks to me through that emotion, speaks to me through that state of consciousness. Can God do that? Absolutely. And he does do that all the time. But it may or may not be spiritual in a biblical sense, depending upon what happens there. But the experience itself is a rare but a natural and normal part of just being a human being. And I think we have a whole lot more to talk about here.
We do.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
So here we are at that time again at the end of our program that we ask people for financial contributions so that we can continue the program. I would like to remind you listeners that our budget for this program isn't really large. In fact, we try to keep our expenses pretty low. But to keep it on the air in the several locations that we're on the air now, I believe it's 7 or 8, that it does take some money to buy that airtime. And again, if 50 of you decided to pledge $10 a month, we would about meet our costs. We'd like pledges from people or financial contributions from people who are really benefiting from this program, so it feels like it's something you're giving to that is important to you. So here's a letter I'd like to share from somebody who does appreciate and value the program. Dear Jack and Christine, I just want to congratulate you both on your past four programs on parenting. It was quite an eye-opener on my own parenting. I am a grandmother and a great also, and I wish I could have heard all this 40 years ago. I also realize we never stop learning, and also how my old nature is so stubborn and sinful that I haven't really changed very much. But you two really bring it right home where the rubber meets the road. You are so special and help all of us when you are so vulnerable on the air and just tell it like it is. I used to feel like I failed so much in my walk with God, but no one said it would be easy. I just can't wait to hear what you will be discussing on future programs. Please, don't leave us now. And I would have to say, you know, I really, really appreciate this kind of letter, as does Jack. And when she says, please don't leave us now, it kind of makes me sad because I'm aware that our funding will probably not cover over, we won't be on the air another couple of years unless we have some significant funding increases. So thank you for considering the possibility of contributing to our ministry.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403.
And you may also find us on the net at www.mackenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of Mackenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. Thank you for listening.